we go. Hey, boys and girls, and the occasional adult that may listen to this show. I am Rish Outfield. This podcast is called The Rish Outcast. And this is an episode wherein I am going to share with you the story, Sleep Talkin' Gal. This is a story that I wrote, I assume it was 2008, might have been a little bit after that, but I started it in 2008. Don't know when I finished it. Could have been 2014. If you've heard it, well, you know whether you like it or not. If you haven't, here it is. Sleep Talking Gal by Rish Outfield. It's not short, so start listening.
Sleep Talking Gal. So, the Wonder Years still hadn't been released on DVD. If thanks or fault need to be laid at just one door, that's probably your best bet. Something about the music rights being tied up or too expensive, so it was just never available to own. Eli Jacobs had been a big fan of the ABC coming-of-age show when he was a teenager, delighting to the nostalgic misfortunes of Kevin Arnold and company. Now that he was in his 30s, he still delighted. But the nostalgia wasn't for the 60s, but for his own youth, just fading into the distance. When he saw the Wonder Years come up on the cable guide, he was excited. The chance to relive it all, the chance to laugh and cry, the chance to appreciate it on a totally different level now that... But it was on at 3 a.m., yes, that fabled middle of the night when they say most people in hospitals die. And he didn't have a TiVo or a working VCR. So he did what he used to do as a little boy to catch Super Friends at the crack of dawn. He set his alarm to wake him up for it. How Eli groaned when the clock began to blare that first night and switched it off quickly. He lay there for a minute, deciding whether he was too tired to watch The Wonder Years or not. Was it really worth it, with work coming in a few short hours? He could probably find a VCR at an electronics store, or more likely, a pawn shop, and that would be cheap and easy. But could he even program one anymore, out of practice as he was? For a moment, he must have drifted off again. But he came back to consciousness when his wife muttered something next to him. "What, honey?" Diane was silent. And Eli figured rest was more important than TV, closing his eyes once again.
"Your sister's going to have two children," he heard her say.
"I hope not," he muttered. Wanda was only 17, barely older than his wife's daughter from her first marriage.
"Aaron and Nathan,"
Diane said. "Who?"
"Aaron and Nathan are their names."
"Whose? Wanda's?" But his wife was back asleep, or rather, still asleep, and heard nothing. After 20 more seconds, he fell asleep as well. He was angry at himself, though, the next day. He couldn't exactly say why, but he wanted to watch the show again, see if it made him feel, now that he was a grown man, what it had made him feel as a boy. He went to bed 15 minutes earlier than usual that night, determined not to be quite so lazy when his late-night alarm buzzed again. He did better. He shut the alarm clock off as quickly as he could, but Diane didn't stir. He put on a T-shirt and headed out to the living room. The Wonder Years was still pretty magical, but it felt more like the 80s than it did the 60s, and Eli was shocked that, in a lot of ways, he related more to Kevin Arnold's dad than to Kevin himself. And Kevin seemed so young, impossibly young, to be growing up and falling in love and have it have any meaning. Still, Eli wandered back from the living room with a nostalgic smile, happy he had made it through the show, despite its unreasonable hour.
Speed, Eli,
Diane said as he entered the room. Up, coming to bed now, he told her. After closing the door behind him, he realized he hadn't caught what she said and turned on the closet light, just in case she wanted something. You need a drink, honey? She didn't answer and didn't stir. He couldn't really see all the way across the room, but she appeared to be already sleeping. He shrugged in his mind, flipped off the closet light. He had never really understood the point of a light inside the closet, and had complained when she'd insisted on it when they'd remodeled the house, but supposed he didn't spend nearly the time in or around the closet that she did. It might have had something to do with his propensity to wear non-matching socks, but it also could have been...
The ticket will cost $90,
his wife said from the bed. What? What ticket? He tried to remember if Jean-Marie, his teenage stepdaughter, had somehow convinced Diane to let her go to that concert she'd mentioned a month or so back. Surely that had passed by now.
Ticket to what?
The woman didn't answer as he approached the bed in the near-perfect darkness of the room.
You okay, honey?
He asked. Diane said nothing more and seemed to be already sleeping again. Eli chuckled. Maybe she had never been awake at all. As far as he remembered, his wife didn't talk in her sleep, but maybe everybody did it from time to time. He'd ask Benny at work. Since Benny was like Wikipedia at the post office, claiming to be an expert at every subject from space exploration to Western novels. Eli got under the covers, kissed Diane on the head, and 10 seconds later was asleep himself. Lately, he'd been listening to the sports talk station on the radio during his morning commute. One of the guys at the post office had turned him onto it, and he, a carrier, listened with earphones during his daily route, even though it was against the rules to do so. He enjoyed the host and the topics the guy presented, and while he seldom agreed with him, Eli never once considered calling the station and telling the guy off himself. The people who did that usually made Eli's point for him, though often they sounded like idiots, or the host made them sound like it, or both. Sometimes the talk would get quite heated, and Eli would get really wrapped up in the show, laughing or rebutting, sometimes yelling at the radio, once missing his freeway exit even though he took the same route home every single day. Today was one of those days that he was really into the sports show, telling the host that he was completely forgetting about Pete Rose and his years with the Reds, even though the host couldn't hear him, and he probably looked like a crazy person to the cars he was whipping past on the... There was a police car behind him, following in his lane. The car's lights began to flash the second Eli noticed it. Eli swore silently and looked down at his speedometer, but he knew he was speeding, even before he saw it was up over 80. 80. Sure enough, there was no talking his way out of the speeding ticket, even though he mentioned the topic of conversation on the radio, hoping the cop would understand. The policeman mentioned that football is the only sport that matters, and went back to his car to start writing out the ticket.
The ticket will cost $90.
When the officer finally came back, he had spent at least 10 minutes back there, letting Eli stew and swear and give the finger to the cars that honked as they drove past. He asked the man how much he thought the ticket would be. The cop either pretended not to know or legitimately didn't, but said it would probably be around 75. Eli didn't remember to talk to Benny about it when he went to the post office that morning. Benny was his closest friend at his job, but he could be something of a blowhard. His two favorite subjects were religion and politics, and he relished the opportunity to demonstrate his knowledge about these and other potentially offensive topics. But the guy was all right, and volunteered to buy Eli lunch at least one day a week, and you can't beat that. At dinner, while his daughter stared out the window and his little boy picked at his food, Eli asked his wife if she was a sleep talker. She had always slept like the dead before, as far as he knew.
Me? No, I don't think so.
Has anybody ever told you you talk in your sleep?
What, like my several boyfriends on the side?
She asked with a smile. But it wasn't one of her husband's jokes, apparently. Diane thought about it.
I don't think so. I've always been a sound sleeper. When my family went to Disneyland when I was 8, There was an earthquake, and everybody woke up but me. I didn't even wake up when they were walking around shouting, "Are you okay?" My mom used to say I could sleep through a demolition derby, but I've never tested that theory.
A simple no would suffice, Eli told her, having already stuck the last piece of chicken in his mouth.
She gave him half a smile. Well, do I? You'd know better than I would.
The last couple of nights, you said something. I assumed you were talking to me, but I'm pretty sure you were asleep.
What did I say?
It was mostly mumbling. I just didn't remember you doing that before. He paused. Do I ever talk in my sleep?
Sometimes, she said, then glanced at her two children.
Neither seemed to be paying attention to their parents' conversation.
It's usually fairly graphic.
Eli was a little embarrassed and a lot intrigued. Like what?
I'll tell you tonight, she told him. If you're good.
They shared a smile. That night, his alarm woke him and he sat up in bed, silencing it before it buzzed twice. He eagerly left the bedroom and turned on the living room TV. The episode was the one where Kevin went to work with his father, and Eli was crying long before Joe Cocker started singing the end theme. He sniffled, turned the set off, and went to the bathroom. When he came into the bedroom, Diane was talking to him again.
Uh-oh.
What? He asked, though he was pretty sure it would be nothing.
Marty is sick,
she said, then mumbled something else. He looked at her face. Her eyes were closed and her expression was vacant.
Marty? Marty who?
But she didn't speak again. He turned off the bathroom light and peeled his t-shirt off.
Who's Marty? He asked her.
But she didn't answer. She was sound asleep, as always. Eli got in bed next to her and thought about it. The only Marty he knew was Martin Aguilar at work, an older man who always played Santa Claus at the office Christmas party. Maybe one of Diane's friends had a kid named Marty. Or a husband. Or Diane was messing around with a guy named Marty. He supposed Marty could be a woman's name. He'd known a woman named Martina who went by Marty back in college. And there was always Marty McFly. He was still thinking on this when he fell asleep again. Eli had a leftover roast beef sandwich Diane had given him, and he took it into the break room at work, hoping there would be enough room so it wouldn't get smashed. Or disappear, since one of those two things always seemed to happen when he left food in the break room fridge. Two of the female clerks were sitting at the table arranging ketchup packets, and he heard one of them say something about, for a man Marty's age. He stopped. Normally he would have minded his own business. But his mind went back to what Diane had said about the ticket and, yes, what she had said the night before.
What's up with Marty?
The pair of women looked up at him. One narrowed her eyes, but the older of the two told him,
Marty Aguilar is in the hospital. His appendix burst.
What happened? Eli asked, suddenly concerned.
His appendix burst.
The younger woman, a heavy-set lady of mixed race, repeated, with shameless irritation. The older lady ignored her friend.
His wife called in, said he was complaining of stomach pains early in the morning. At 5, the younger one clarified. And he drove himself to the emergency room, where his appendix burst, like 10 minutes after they got there. They said he might have died if it had burst at home.
Because he's too fat and too old,
the younger one said, as though Aguilar had brought it upon himself. That's terrible, Eli said. But he was thinking of his wife at 3:30, sleep-talking, Marty is sick.
Some of the clerks were going to put some money together to buy him flowers,
the older woman, her name tag said Sharon, told him.
If you want to give, why would a man want flowers?
The other woman, her tag said her name was Clarissa with a Y, interjected. She looked at Eli.
What would a man do with flowers?
Eli shrugged. He didn't know what a woman would do with flowers either, but it was the thought that counted. He gave Sharon a $5 bill, briefly considering if that was too much, then went out to sort the mail. Afterward, he had two thoughts. One,
that his wife had somehow known about Marty Aguilar's illness, and two, that $5 might have been on the chintzy side. It was all he thought about that day. But when he went home, Diane had a headache and was irritable, and he chose to do some yard work and hang out with the boy instead of talk to her about it. His wife went to sleep early, and when Eli retired, he deliberated for a moment before turning out the reading light. "Did you know about Marty Aguilar?" he asked quietly. "Do you even know who he is?" She didn't answer, and he let it go. But he was barely drowsing when his Wonder Years alarm went off at 2:58. He sat up in bed, turned off the buzzer, and spoke to his wife in the dark. "Anything interesting to say, Diane?" She said nothing. He could hear her breathing, but she didn't stir. He got up, watching the show, but feeling distracted, wondering if his crazy theory was at all possible and sane. When the episode ended, he didn't even wait for the credits, just turned off the TV and headed back to the bedroom. With the hall light on, he could see Diane sleeping peacefully on her side of the bed. He watched her with interest, and it occurred to him that he didn't look at her while she was sleeping anymore. When they'd first gotten married, he had often watched her in the early morning and felt waves of love for her that were like a throbbing sunburn. She had been so beautiful and so perfect-looking asleep there. It had been like staring at an angel. And he usually had patted her hair or kissed her forehead before falling back to sleep, grateful for the hand life had dealt him. In the years since, something had changed. She was still attractive, though heavier, older. But now, he only looked at her when they were in a conversation, or it was his bi-weekly sex appointment. And he never watched her sleeping anymore. Getting his own rest was now the priority. At 3:32, she moved in the bed, mumbling to herself. He moved quickly to her side, listening closely, anticipation tickling inside his stomach.
"Long time,"
she muttered. He leaned closer, his eyes growing larger. She said 7 words, clearly and slowly.
"In the bushes you will find them."
He smiled big. "What, honey? What will I find?" She said something else, or it might have been a grunt, then went silent. "Diane," Eli said, "what will I find?" She didn't stir. He touched her shoulder. "Diane, sweetie." Her eyes opened.
What is it?"
"What will I find?" She blinked in the semi-darkness, looking at him confusedly.
"What?"
"You said I'd find them in the bushes. What will I find?" She rubbed at her eye, exhaling, and looked at him again.
"Sorry, I don't understand."
He sighed. "Okay, never mind. Go back to sleep."
"You go back to sleep too," she said. "Did you watch your show?"
But she had closed her eyes and, true to form, was asleep again. That fast. The next day was Thursday, and he kept repeating in his mind, "In the bushes you will find them." It was a mystery, and his mind did come up with some creepy interpretations of that sentence. He thought about kittens. He thought about gold doubloons. He thought about peeping toms. He imagined a couple of neighborhood children disappearing and how that prophecy could come true. Finally, he drove home from work and went around his house peering in the bushes. Right beside the back door, in the rose bushes that had grown out of control, he saw something shiny. Down on his hands and knees, scraping 2 of his fingers, he discovered his car keys, lost somewhere in the house, 3 or 4 months back, to the point where he had made his stepdaughter tear apart the living room, going through cushions and looking behind furniture and piano for where he'd misplaced them. He'd spent $116 to replace the house key, car key, and work keys, because they'd never turned up.
"Why couldn't you have said this 6 months ago?"
he asked his wife, who wasn't within earshot. That night, Eli considered not even watching The Wonder Years. He knew Diane said things between 3:30 and 3:35, but what if she said things at 3:00?
things at least as important as where his car keys were. So, he skipped the episode, and sat by her side, the reading lamp on, listening for prophecy. At 3:14, he thought about going out and getting the newspaper, but a little voice at the back of his mind insisted that she'd start talking the second he left the room. At 3:24, she made a noise, but it was just a swallow, and nothing came after it. It was 3:32, just as the night before, when she hummed and opened her mouth, saying something incomprehensible. He held his breath, hoping she would continue. She did.
Dow Jones up 168 points,
Diane Jacobs said. Eli gasped. This was exactly the crazy sort of thing that would happen in a movie. Something real, something potentially profitable. When, honey? When will it go up? She didn't respond. She was still, breathing slow and deep, very much asleep. At work the next morning, Eli talked to his friend Benny in the sorting room. What do you know about the stock market? He asked. And as Benny began a long-winded explanation of how long he had dabbled and what it had garnered him in the 7 years he'd been playing around with various stocks, Eli interrupted with, Do you have a broker? Do you know how to buy shares of the Dow Jones? Yes and yes, Benny said. And why? I just have a feeling, Eli said. He had checked the Dow Jones at 3:40 last night in the newspaper, making a note of where the stocks rested, hoping that he'd have time to buy some the next day. Diane hadn't predicted when it would go up, and the same little voice in his mind that had provided the chilling thought about kidnapped and murdered children told him that the Dow might very well go up in 5 years. But he had a little bit of money set aside, something he was saving for either an anniversary present, this November, or a family vacation, the past summer. Benny put Eli in contact with his broker, who told him that the Dow was actually half a point lower than it had been in yesterday's newspaper. Although he suggested Eli diversify his investment and recommended a couple of high-quality and very dependable mutual funds, Eli spent $612 on shares of the Dow Jones during lunch that Friday. He was told that he could give the broker a call in a month or so and see how things were doing, and that a statement would be mailed every quarter, but Eli wanted to know where the Dow was at the end of the day. It was right where it had been, with pretty much no fluctuation. Both the broker and Benny wanted to explain to Eli how the stock market worked, and that you couldn't expect an immediate loss or gain unless you had some kind of inside information, which wouldn't work on something like the Dow Jones. That the best thing he could do would just be to forget about the $600 and come back to it only when he really needed the money. Maybe it would be at 610, maybe it would be at 700, maybe it would be at 550, but a man would do himself no good checking out stock values daily or weekly, not when it was such an insignificant amount as 612, minus broker fees, of course. But Eli felt confident he had done the right thing. He had known about Marty Aguilar's appendicitis only an hour or two before it had happened, and she'd known he'd find the keys the day before. Not that he would have looked had she not made the prediction about the bushes. He started to second-guess himself, wondering when his son would ask one of his traditional, "When are we going to Disneyland?" questions next, and what he would tell him if the vacation money was gone. The next day was Saturday, and the market was closed for the weekend. He did housework, took the kids out to wash the car, hit the hardware store, and bought a toy and some apples at Target. Wonder Years wasn't on Saturdays, but he set his alarm nonetheless, hoping that his wife's predictions had nothing to do with that 80s TV show. At 2:58, the alarm went off. He got up, used the toilet, shaved to kill time, and read the newspaper in the bed while waiting the half hour before his wife would start talking. He told himself to change the alarm to wake himself up at 3:30 the next night, but for now, he would just wait the half hour out. He opened his eyes, the light still on, upon hearing his wife say something at his side. He sat up in bed, the newspaper crinkling under him.
Somehow he'd fallen asleep again, and, sure enough, Diane had slept-talked, her voice jarring him awake.
"What, honey?"
Eli said softly. "What did you say?"
"Monsieur,"
she mumbled, then went quiet again. He looked at his alarm clock. 3:33 a.m. "Damn it," he said, probably a little too loudly. His wife did not stir. Well, on Sunday night, he didn't make that mistake again. He'd set the alarm for 3:30, and when it awoke him, he'd gotten out of bed and walked around to Diane's side to sort of squat by her slumbering form. The 2 minutes before she began to speak were interminable, and he thought about maybe getting one of those mini tape recorders, though he supposed they were digital now, that can be set to automatically record any noise, put it right by your pillow, and listen every morning to what she'd said. He could impress her by letting her hear her own sleep voice, and they could interpret her comments together. It might even bring them closer as a couple. Or, he supposed, she could be freaked out to hear it, tell him to stop, maybe even consider it an invasion of her privacy. He didn't know. And she'd been doing it for a week now, and he hadn't told her about the keys or Marty Aguilar or the stock exchange. Why? Did he think that somehow that would jinx it? To let her know what was going on? And when Benny had asked what was up with the Dow Jones, why hadn't he told Benny either? Maybe it was too preposterous. Maybe he knew he wouldn't be believed. Or worse, what if when he told someone, the minute somebody knew other than him? Diane began to sleep talk. At first, as usual, it wasn't intelligible. And then, as usual, something clear and complete came out.
"This year, Joshua's birthday will be..."
Eli held his breath.
"On a Thursday."
And that was it. For the second time in as many nights, he swore aloud to the quiet bedroom. On Monday, the Dow Jones went up 168 points. He didn't know what else to do, since his wife had made no other prediction but that. He called up Benny's broker, who was now his broker as well, he figured, and told him to sell.
"Oh, Eli, buddy, it's like I was saying," the broker began. "You can't just buy and sell based on one day alone. Fluctuations happen. Maybe by close today, it'll be up 10 more points. Maybe tomorrow, it'll go up even further."
It was just an experiment, Daniel," Eli said. "It went up a few points, and I'm fine with that."
The man did try to dissuade him again, but Eli told him he was just learning and that he'd let it ride the next time he made an investment. The broker replied that letting it ride was a gambling term, and Eli probably needed to understand the market more if he was thinking of it like a horse race or football bet, but ultimately assured him that within the hour he'd sell all his stock and have a check ready for him by Wednesday. Eli thanked him and promised to use him again the next time he made an investment. After this successful attempt, if his wife ever mentioned the stock market again, or horse races, football games, or Vegas odds, he'd do it with a lot more money, maybe their entire savings, since he now felt like he was dealing with a sure thing here. And yes, he had checked the calendar to see what day his son's birthday fell in the new calendar year. Sure enough, Thursday was right. Useless as that little prediction had been. That evening, as they were getting ready for bed, Eli asked Diane if she believed in fortune tellers and palm reading and tarot cards, that sort of thing.
"Have you ever been to one? Or a psychic?" she asked.
They had attended the local church they'd gotten married in for the first couple of years they'd been together, but neither one had been particularly religious, and it had been 2 Christmases since they'd stepped foot in a chapel.
"No, but answer my question."
She rubbed the bridge of her nose.
"No, I don't believe in fortune tellers. Do you?"
"Do you believe any of that stuff could be real? Horoscopes and telephone psychics and the stuff Nostradamus predicted and all that?"
She looked at him quizzically.
"Do you want to start going to Sunday school again, Eli? Is that what this is about?"
"No," he said. "Then, probably not. I just..."
"Just what?"
Now was his moment. the opportunity to just go for it, open up the subject and talk the whole thing through. Talk about faith, talk about prophecies, miracles, possibilities. It was the sort of thing they would have done when they were first going out, or newlyweds, when it seemed so important to get to know each other, their pasts and beliefs and attitudes and dreams. It was something they rarely did now, unless they were talking about the children. And even then, it lacked energy and real interest. This was the chance to change all that.
"Nothing," he said. "Just thinking aloud."
Late that night, Diane Jacobs' sleep said something about her daughter, Jean-Marie. Something disturbing.
"Our 13-year-old daughter has touched a penis."
He sat up straighter in bed. "Oh, God, Diane, please tell me you're joking." She didn't budge. And after murmuring something that sounded like,
"She'll lose her virginity on September 2nd,
she fell silent once again. Eli wasn't very tired anymore all of a sudden. Breakfast was a bit awkward the next morning. Eli kept glancing at his stepdaughter, who was pretending to finish up her homework before catching the bus, when it was obvious she was just now starting it, and glancing away, embarrassed. The things that were popping into his head were shameful. But who should be more ashamed? Finally, as it was time for her to run out and be at the bus stop, he said,
"Jean-Marie, are you enjoying school?"
"School?"
"Your classes, I mean."
"Yeah, I guess."
He studied her. She wasn't an ugly girl, nor a stunner, and might be attractive to the boys in her school. But Eli just couldn't see her already becoming sexually active. She was quiet and shy and seemed not to have gotten past the awkward age yet. But that didn't mean there wasn't peer pressure, or curiosity about sex, or simple, universal loneliness. "Are you happy?" he asked her. She seemed to consider not answering him.
"Sort of,"
she said, shrugging.
"Sometimes I am." "Why?"
"No reason," Eli said. "Have a good day, sweetheart."
She rolled her eyes and sped out of the room. He figured he'd have to just give her up, assign her to being lost to him. She was never his to begin with. But a moment later, Jean-Marie popped back into the kitchen and kissed him on the cheek.
"You have a good one too, Dad,"
she said, and took off again. Diane. They were in a restaurant, Thai, for their monthly dinner date. He'd been considering ordering something else, but really wanted to talk instead. She finished chewing what she had in her mouth before saying,
"Yes?"
"I keep thinking of what you said about J.M., Eli said over his menu.
"Jean-Marie? When?"
"Last night."
"Remind me, what did I say about her?"
"You..."
He glanced around, but their waitress was at another table, refilling water glasses.
"In the night, you thought she was going to lose her virginity at 14.
"What?" Diane gasped, putting her fork down. "Lord, I hope not." That had been his reaction as well. He knew by now what the answer would be, but he still asked,
"You don't remember saying that to me?"
"No. As far as I know, she's kissed a boy. Once."
"That's it?"
"I think so. She'd tell me if she'd done more."
But Eli didn't think so. Not if the sleeping Diane somehow knew things the conscious Diane did not. But that wasn't possible, was it? This was magic, or telepathy, or whatever you called it. Stuff Eli Jacobs didn't believe in. Or hadn't. Just a few days before. 5 days in a row, he set his alarm to wake him at 3:32 a.m., skipping the TV show. And 5 nights in a row, his wife said something in her sleep. Once, it was utterly worthless, even less so than the birthday thing.
"This is General Hospital's 46th season on television."
Once, it had been interesting, but not beneficial.
"Josh is going to do badly on his spelling test. Encyclopedia only has one I in it."
Once he hadn't understood her at all.
Between 4 and 5, more or less.
Honey, Eli said, tapping her gently, then softly shaking her arm. She said, which everyone has said at one time or another. What did you mean?
Eli,
she asked, blinking at his bedside lamp, her eyes going to the digital alarm clock on the dresser.
What?
You said something in your sleep.
Sorry, I must have been dreaming.
What about? She scowled.
God, I have such a headache.
I'll get you a Tylenol. Try to remember your dream, okay? When he came back upstairs with the 2 pills and a glass of water, she'd already gone to sleep. That left Wednesday, when Diane had said that Simon Sims would get the next carrier promotion. It's not really even worth mentioning, but while Eli enjoyed his job more or less, he always felt he deserved a better position and a better salary. He wasn't the brown noser that some of the employees were, and he wouldn't call the postmaster his friend, but he knew he worked hard and should be rewarded for it soon. And Simon Sims, well, he wasn't a hard person to work with, not like that woman from the break room named Clarissa with a Y, but he hadn't earned it like Eli had. And Simon Sims was a really obnoxious name now that he thought about it. Sure enough, Sims's promotion was announced on Friday, just a day after Diane had made her prediction. Eli was grouchy about that, and was a little upset with Diane when she complained of a headache and begged off going to the movies with him that night. His stepdaughter Jean-Marie said she might like to go, but he looked at her and couldn't help thinking about her sexual experimentation. At 13, it made him almost physically ill. Eli did broach the unspoken subject with his older brother when they got together one afternoon for Sunday dinner. It was just the two of them at the table, the kids and wives temporarily out of the room. "Can I talk to you about something, man?" Jeff made a chuffing sound and shrugged, embarrassed. "Yeah, they're implants."
"What?"
"You got me. Nobody else seemed to notice."
"Huh?"
Eli didn't know what that was about.
No, something about Diane.
"Sure thing." Jeff took a drink. "You two doing all right?"
"Yes," he said without thinking. "It's... well..."
He glanced behind him, but his wife was still in the kitchen with Jeff's wife, working on dessert.
"Diane sometimes says... things,"
he semi-explained.
"They don't make sense. But later, they do, you know?"
Jeff snorted, dismissing it.
"Women are all like that, man."
"I mean to say, she ends up being right about things in the future."
"You'll never figure it out, Eli," his brother said. "Why do you think women live longer than men?"
"Has your wife, or any of them, ever said something to you, made a prediction, and it later came true?"
Jeff didn't even take time to process what Eli was saying.
"Mindy, when we first got married. She told me I'd get sick if I ate seafood when we were in Providence. I thought she was paranoid."
He made a face at the uncomfortable memory.
"And sure enough, the whole trip, I was perched over the toilet, either one end of me or the other. Charming."
"But what about other stuff?"
persisted Eli, hoping to say it without having to say it.
"Any predictions you can't explain?"
"No, nothing."
Jeff finished his beer.
"Why, is Diane able to do that? Can she pick horse races or tell me the score of next week's Spurs game?"
Eli laughed, not very convincing to himself, but passable for his big brother.
"No, nothing like that. Forget I mentioned it."
But he did remember his brother's words that night, when he kissed Diane goodnight and turned out his bedside lamp. He would make a conscious effort to push his wife's predictions in the direction he desired. It was 3:28, and he went to her side and softly whispered to her,
"Honey, tonight, let's focus on gambling. Sporting events, lottery numbers, races, the stock market, that sort of thing.
Something that we could make money with. Diane, give me something clear and easy to understand. Something to make our financial situation better.
At 3:32, she grunted and began her nightly prognosis.
Christmas will be on a Tuesday next year.
He didn't try after that. It was always a mystery what she would say each night, and he hoped it wasn't too long before she came around to a helpful prediction again. In the meantime, she seemed distant, often going to bed early, complaining of not feeling well, or spending so long in the bathtub that the water was cold when she finally came out. He thought it might be nice to get her some flowers. Be nicer if he could get her a winning lottery ticket, too, he thought. So he stopped off on the way home for some carnations, pink and white. And while she smiled and kissed him on the cheek, she didn't show any of the exuberance she would have a few years before if he had surprised her with something like that. There was one evening that she didn't even make her prediction. She had been awake at the time, in the bathroom with the door locked. He knocked before going in to watch Wonder Years. It turned out to be one of the lesser episodes, the one where Paul became a basketball star, asking if she was all right, if she'd be heading back to bed soon. She said,
"In a minute,"
and her voice sounded pinched and strained. He'd gone out to watch the show, but when he came back to bed, she was still in the bathroom, 2 minutes before her predicting time started. "Honey, are you okay?" he asked.
"I'm fine,"
she said through the door, sounding anything but fine.
"You go on to sleep. I'll be out soon."
What are you doing in there?"
"Eli, do you need to use the bathroom?"
she asked.
"No, I'm fine. Are you?"
"I'm fine too,"
she said loudly, perhaps too loudly. At 3:32, she was still in there. The door still closed, and as far as he heard, she said nothing. He asked her the next morning what was going on, and she told him she had a nosebleed.
"Why didn't you say that?"
he asked. He had actually begun to suspect her of having morning sickness, although they definitely weren't trying for another kid.
"I don't know,"
she told him, her face still a little pale and wan.
"It was kind of personal, you know?"
"Personal?" Eli said. "I tell you about the color and consistency of my poop."
"Yes,"
she winced.
"And I really wish you wouldn't."
One night, waiting for the Wonder Years sleep-talking gal double feature, Eli went in the bathroom and noticed a line of blood on the side of the sink. In the garbage can, a pair of spotted tissues had been tossed. Her prophecy, or whatever you call it, was pretty uninteresting.
"It's going to rain between 4 and 5.
And he asked her about the blood the next morning.
"Oh, I had a nosebleed while you were picking up Jeremy. Sorry about the mess."
He told her it was no big deal, and remembered this kid he knew in junior high, Garrett, who used to get nosebleeds all the time. It had been so bad that he had gone to the doctor to get it cauterized, which, when described, sounded to a teenaged Eli like a remnant of the Spanish Inquisition. The next night was business as usual. Diane was asleep as soundly as ever, and as soon as a little help from my friends had faded, he was in the bedroom, under the covers, and listening closely. Diane made her prediction.
"The dentist will find 2 cavities.
Which didn't seem too specific or too important, although Eli did make sure to floss that night. And then, on Friday night, it all changed.
"Eli,"
she said. And before he could ask, "Yes, honey," she said,
"You will remarry."
"I will?" he asked, more than a little taken aback.
"A woman named Alex,"
Diane intoned. Her eyes were closed, her face expressionless.
"Short for Alexandria."
The words chilled him. She inhaled, pursed her lips, let out the breath, and mumbled,
"Not long now."
And that was all.
Maybe I'll just hold it.
I want you to hold it between your knees.
Hey guys, I apologize. That's where we're going to end this episode today. Look, it was intended to just be a single episode, Sleep Talking Gal. I recorded this months ago and just barely got to it, editing it today. I was going to look for some Kevin MacLeod music to lay under it and was putting the file together, and I realized that it's long, much longer than the normal episode, you know, short story sharing. And so I decided to make two episodes out of it. Does that make me greedy? Does that make me bad? Funny, I had this friend in LA. He would say these most outlandish things. Just awful, incendiary things. You know, just like, that's why all children should be rounded up and placed in cages and prodded with sharp sticks. Or, that's why all women with red hair should have their heads and eyebrows shaved. And then he'd say, oh, I'm sorry, was that bad? And the first time he did it, it was really funny. And we laughed pretty hard because it was just like so obviously like he had come up with something offensive to say. And believe me, those two examples I used are light examples. And then he said, oh, was that bad? And he said it in like this wide-eyed, are we really not supposed to make fun of minorities voice, that we laughed. But that was a mistake because he would do it all the time. Anyhow, that's where I'm going to end the story presentation for this week. And don't worry, I'll be back next week with the second half. But if you want to go out and buy Sleep Talking Gal, it is available. The audio version that you just heard is available in my first audio collection, which was The Calling and Other Stories, and it's also available. Maybe I'll put that in the show notes. Anyhow, I had already edited this whole thing, as I said. I'd done the whole episode. All I was doing was laying in the story tracks, and then I was going to do music. And I just realized, well, we're going to have another one of those two-hour episodes, which is not the end of the world. See, now I have to think about money. Is it worth $2 for both halves of the short story? I don't know. So I was deciding tonight, right now I'm taking a walk. There's a nice breeze blowing. Hopefully it's not blowing on the microphone, making all of this audio unusable. Although you know me, I'd still use it. But I had to decide where to cut the story off. In my collection, the one that I just mentioned, I split it into 7 parts, like chapters, only each chapter consisted of 2 or 3 segments of the story. Do you know what I mean by segments? Scenes, basically, like in a screenplay. Anytime you change locations or time, it's a new scene. And I had split that up into 7 parts. And so if it were 6 parts or 8 parts, it would be easy to just, okay, at the end of the fourth part, the end of the third part, we cut it off. But because it was an odd number, I was just going to do the math, find like more or less the midpoint, and arbitrarily end it there. And I think that's what I did. So I tried 2 or 3 different spots where I was like, okay, I could end it here. This segment is all right. I was going to end it after she made the prediction about the daughter, you know, losing her virginity. And I thought, well, that's not emotionally strong. I thought, okay, well, the part about the lottery numbers, you know, I was like, honey, can you focus on lottery numbers? I thought, well, that's okay, but tonally it's not exactly what I'm looking for. And then it came to me what part I wanted to end it on. You know, I tend to be a horror writer. I think of myself as a horror writer first and foremost, and not everything that I share on this show is horror, certainly. I try to be pretty well-rounded as far as what I share. But yeah, it's just like horror is my baby, my bag, my forte, my true north. And with horror, you know, a lot of times it's emotional. It's an image. It's a revelation. It's a surprise, you know, a twist. Or a line that is ominous. A line that holds dread or portends something bad coming. And so, of course, I chose Not Long Now as where I was going to stop the narrative, because, at least in my mind, that is the high point of the story. The, I don't know if high point, but that's the part that I think of that is the crux of the story. You know, it's the bedrock of the story. It's, what is the story about? Well, it's about a guy whose wife says things while she's asleep that start to come true. And see, that can be comedy. That can be sad. That can be exciting. That can be kind of wish fulfillment. Or it could be scary. And the moment when the story stops being, gosh, now he's got an uncomfortable breakfast with his daughter knowing that she's touched a penis, is it, after I'm gone, you will remarry. Not long now. Now, you may agree or you may disagree, because part of a thriller, part of horror, part of drama is your gut, how it hits you, your emotional reaction to something. And you may say, well, that wasn't scary at all. That was lame. What a terrible place to end the story. Why not end it in the scene before that? Or it would have been a much stronger place to end it right here, wherever that happens to be. But I chose Not Long Now because, to me, that is the point of highest drama. That is when you go to commercial. Or, in this case, that's the end of the episode, to be continued next week. Please come back next week for the conclusion of Sleep Talking Gal. A lot of the stuff that I write is, it's visual. You know, I felt like my calling was to write for the movies or to write for television, to be a screenwriter. And I see his face when he hears that, the dread of it, the, oh my goodness, what does that mean? And then you hold on that and you fade to black. If I did my job, then it worked. Then it makes you want to come back next week. There can be different kinds of act outs, as they call it in television, you know, teleplay writing. And that takes sort of a skill set that I may not have because I didn't have to write for television. But coming up with a dramatic beat where you can cut to commercial, and it always has to be a moment that'll keep them coming back, you know, oh, they want to know what happens. That to me seems really difficult to do. You know, if you're doing it on a sitcom, I mean, yeah, I guess it's a big laugh you can go to commercial on, but I'll bet it's more of the opportunity for a big laugh. The door opens and oh no, the mother-in-law is there. How are we going to explain ourselves? You cut to commercial. Or, honey, you're home. How was the trip? That kind of thing. You go to commercial. Because there is potential for comedy, there's potential for conflict. And yeah, that's what it's like with Not Long Now. Anyhow, I appreciate you coming on this half journey with me. Let me know in the comments if you are upset that I split it in two, or if you understand, but you're still upset, and whether that's okay or not. There's a novella that I'm going to present on the show soon, and I deliberately set that up as two parts. Whereas last year I did Stormy Weather, and I recorded it two different ways. I said, okay, so here's where I'm going to end if this is two parts, and please ignore this if it ends up just being one part, because I hadn't edited Stormy Weather, the story, yet to know how long it was. I should have known, though. I mean, that's kind of a hefty little tale. Anyhow, I'm going to leave you, let you go on your way, and hopefully you will join me again in just a few days for the second half. Already in progress, as they say. Thanks for joining me on this. I know I already said that, but it's worth reiterating. You know, I'm not an expert at this. I have been podcasting for 9 years now, and I feel like I'm good at that. Big Anklevich the other day was saying how much he's grown or changed in the years since we started the Doonstief, and that he's gotten better at certain things from that experience. And I felt like that was a compliment on, you know, us working together. But, you know, when I recorded this episode for Sleep Talking Gal, he was still living here. We were still getting together every Monday. I tried to record an episode every other Monday on the drive to see him. But now he's gone, and we haven't done anything. We talked on the phone twice since he's left, and I don't know if we will continue to podcast together. But I am doing this. I'm in it for the long haul. But the point I was trying to make was, I don't know whether I'm doing this right, whether you guys look forward to every single episode, whether you feel like what I have to say is worth listening to, or whatever the step above what is worth listening to is. It's something you look forward to. My Uncle Len briefly was a DJ, a radio DJ, when I was 18 or so, 19. And I thought, wow, that sounds like a really cool job. And maybe I was a little older, maybe I was like 21, 22. But I asked him, I was just like, what do you do and how is that? And he's like, well, mostly I just play the songs, tell people who the song was, what the name of the song was, what's coming up next, what the weather is going to, what the temperature is, what time it is, and cut to commercial. And I just thought, well, that's not as glamorous as I imagined. And he says, oh, you don't understand. It's the most fun I've had at a job. I love going to work every day. I'm a different person on the radio. People don't know who I am, and I can just make myself whoever I want to be. And I thought, wow, that sounds awesome. He says, it is awesome. I just wish that it paid the bills. I just wish that it paid the bills. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I'm going to have to quit. You can't make a living with a four-hour shift every day on a radio station. I've got kids, I got a mortgage, I got a wife. Even if I didn't, I don't think I could make it with that few hours every week. But maybe none of this story is true. Maybe I made it all up because I desperately didn't want to hang up. Hang up like we're on the phone together. No, you hang up, honey. You hung up. You say it first. I just didn't want to end the show. There's kind of some truth to that. But yeah, Uncle Len ended up having to quit that job, and he had to go do manual labor that he liked less, because that's what you do when you have a family. And that always made me sad, that he found a job that he loved and he couldn't keep doing it. I don't remember why I even brought that up. Maybe I should have cut it all out. But I think what reminded me of Len's story was that I'm still doing the podcast by myself. I would still do it even if there weren't Patreon supporters. And I would still do it if there were 10 times as many Patreon supporters. Nudge, nudge. It's something that I really enjoy. It's something I feel I'm good at, but that's relative. Anyway, I try to get the story episodes out there. And now, one story episode has become two story episodes. So, thanks again. I've been Rish Outfield. Sleep well.
The music in today's episode was presented by Kevin MacLeod of the website Incompetech.com. The Rish Outcast really should not exist. But since it does, I suppose the best that can be said of it is that it was produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. Of course, that's a little bit like noticing the piranhas eating you of a very attractive coloring.
I hear the secrets that you keep when you're talking in your sleep. I hear the secrets that you keep when you're talking in your sleep.